Well, I did a commercial with Jackie Chan. I directed Jackie Chan in a commercial.
What was that like?
That was amazing. Yeah. He was very humble. And he basically almost ad-libbed his way through this commercial. It was for Turner Broadcasting.
Yeah.
And what he had to do was say, oh, my favorite film is, you know, Lassie Come Home and Tarzan and Singing in the Rain. So he started off by saying, Lancia Come Home. I said, no, stop, no, cut. I said, no, it's Lassie. Lassie come home. Oh, Lancia come home. No, Lassie. And then it was Singing in the Rain, and it was Tarzan.
Oh, yeah.
And Tarzan is swinging through the trees. Ooh. And at the end of the commercial, and we didn't even write this, he says something like, I love Gene Kelly. I love Gene Kelly and Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
I want to be Chinese Gene Kelly. And it was just brilliant, you know?
But what was your experience of being amidst geology that's 3.5-4 billion years old? How did it make you feel as a human being?
Insignificant.
But in a good way, would you say? Yeah,
in a good way. But you kind of realize that you're here for just a little blip in time, and it kind of made me when I went on that trip, we've all got egos. I probably had quite a big ego, but I was
you took the words out of my mouth.
The landscape actually reduced me down and diminished all that till I was just serving the film, and I was just I became not invisible, but almost like a grain of sand. I would win the job mostly, Margaret used to reckon, when I had a hangover. She'd say, because you don't care. You go in there, you don't actually care. And that's the thing, to get to a point where you don't, if you look like you're desperate or you're sort of, I really want this job.
Yeah.
It's like you're not going to get it. But if you sit there and you're confident and you look like you don't give a crap, it's funny how it works in your favor.
It brings a degree of truth, doesn't it? I had an acting coach once, and he'd say, fatigue will win. and that's when the truth comes.
After a week with Father Joe, I walk off down the street through the slums, and I think to myself, God, I'm privileged. I am so honored not to just know this man, but to have understood him, have filmed him. But also, he's given me access to this secret world in Klong Toi where no one's allowed.
Yeah.
And this is a secret world where I have witnessed the most beautiful human beings doing things. Like, I'm sweating and I'm really exhausted. It's a hot day, and I've got the camera, and I'm outside somebody's little shack. Some old lady comes out, and she says, excuse me, sir, here's a stool. And she gets a stool for me, and then she has a glass of water for me. And I look at her, and my eyes tear up, because I just think, you know what? You have nothing, yet you are capable of showing me the greatest love and empathy.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, I am here in a very, very confused, a threatened world, because here in front of me are two film producers. I feel as if I'm with Cecil B. DeMille and Steven Spielberg. Chip, you must be in seventh heaven.
Truly, only you could put me on the level with Spielberg, but thank you for it, Boone. It is exciting. It's electric in here. Hey, you feel that, James, can't you?
Oh, absolutely.
That's beautiful. Thing.
I'm announcing right up front, Chip, that you're going to take over this podcast because I won't get a question in today, mate.
Now, mate, I think you're definitely giving me too much credit there if you think I can override the conversational steamroller that is Bernie Kelly. But mate, I'll give him my best shot.
Mate, we'll give our listeners the best shot right here and now. Just tell them a little bit of our very, very special guest.
We've got James Lingwood with us today, director, producer, maker of Just about every film. There is, would you say, documentarian, hotel films, promos, TVC, short films, feature films, the whole kit. I mean, there's probably no sort of, certainly no kind of narrative filmmaking you haven't touched. Would you say that's fair?
That's fair, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So storied and a genuine international man of mystery. been all over the world.
That's right.
Straight down the barrel too.
James, we've probably never heard of it. What's the greatest film you've ever made?
Probably Voyage of the Great Southern Art, the documentary series. Mm.
Okay. Give us a one-minute description. What was it all about?
It was a 4-billion-year history of the evolution of the Australian continent via biology, botany, and whatever else there is. Geology, everything in the universe.
Other sciences, aren't there?
But it was an amazing 4-month filming shoot around the whole of Australia,
amazing.
Which I was incredibly privileged to be part of because there are places in Australia that, you know, that people haven't seen. I mean, there's certainly places that I hadn't seen. One of them was Mount Narea, which was in Western Australia.
Yeah.
And Mount Narea is as the rocks that are jutting out from the earth are 3.6 billion years old. And to lie there at night, to sleep there in our sleeping bags and look at the stars in the heavens and just think, my God, this is 3.6 billion years old.
Yeah.
So the crew were foraging around for bits of rock because we thought we'd put them on key rings. Hey, look at my key ring. I've got a 3.6 billion year rock here.
That is the perfect marriage of the cosmic and the mundane right there too, isn't it?
I wasn't expecting to ask you this, but what was your experience of being amidst geology that's 3.5-4 billion years old? How did it make you feel as a human being?
Insignificant.
But in a good way, would you say? Yeah,
in a good way. But you kind of realize that you're here for just a little blip in time. And it kind of made me, you know, when I went on that trip, we've all got egos. I probably had quite a big ego. But I was,
you took the words out of my mouth.
The landscape actually reduced me down and diminished all that till I was just serving the film, and I was just, I became, you know, not invisible, but almost like a grain of sand.
G'day, listeners, you shining swans upon the lake of introspection. It's Chip here, and please forgive my interruption, but I could not let that thought pass without sprinkling on a pinch of the spice of my loaded questions. Because if ever we've come across a worthy idea in this podcast, it's what James just said. He felt not invisible, but a grain of sand. I think that perfectly encapsulates the state of mind we're questing for, which is an acknowledgement of our insignificance in the service of achieving a significant life. And the lesson that I think we hear again and again from every guest in their own way is this: to be significant, to live significantly, we have to let go of our feelings of self-importance. Humanity has been around for a few 100,000 years. You will be around for 100 or so years if you're lucky. The universe has been around for over 4 billion years. So many came before you. So many will come after. And yet we all go about our days as if what we are and what we want is the most important thing in the world. And it makes us anxious and ignorant and unhappy because it makes us the whole focus of all space and time instead of being just one more link, one more grain of sand in the beach of all space and time. So here's the question, and I ask it because I never thought to ask it myself, and I think it's a step toward achieving that critical mindset. When was the last time you really considered the people who will inherit the earth when you're gone and what they might need? And when was the last time you really thought about your great grandmother and what kind of world she thought she was leaving to you?
Made me realize what that saying is. You know, you're just but a grain of sand.
Yeah.
You know, you think about it and you just, oh, yeah, what does it mean? You know, yeah. But, yeah, really, grain of sand.
Buddy, this is what I love about this podcast, because I had a full intention of going a certain direction here at the start. Now you've just railroaded in a different direction. I got to ask you, what is the advantage? Is there any value in all of us recognizing that we're just a grain of sand upon the biggest beach, that we're just a speck of dust on Mount Everest? What's the advantage for us seeing our lives that way?
Well, I think you kind of realize that because you're a grain of sand, you know, as you get older, this happens as you get older, you realize there's less and less time to actually do the things you want to do.
Yeah.
When you're younger, you think, oh, look at that old prick, you know, or that old guy running along, you know, what does he think he is? Yeah. But we all go to that same place.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably the lesson to be learned is that you reflect on that fact that you are just a small little piece of something, a small piece of matter in the history of time.
Yeah.
But you can, that little small piece of matter can make a difference.
Yeah.
So while you're on Earth, it's important to see what other people are doing, to help other people, to actually smile, to be joyous.
Yeah.
To, you know, I go for a run, I go for a jog, there's people walking along with dogs and all.
I kind of think
I'm going to smile at every single person today, and I do. I go, hello, how are you?
Yeah.
Most of them smile back.
Yeah.
Some of them go, what the fuck does he want?
Yeah.
Sorry
about
that. But yeah.
You got four. I got four left.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. But it stops us from also taking ourselves so seriously.
Yep.
You know, in the game of life, we can think that we're the most important thing that's ever been born. And guess what? We're not. We're a blimp.
Yeah.
Here today, gone tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mate, that's what a sensational experience that must have been in creating that film. Hey, mate, you've met a few good ones.
One or two.
I'm referring to the actors.
One or two.
And the actresses.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
One
mate,
or two.
Come on, elevate yourself, mate. We want to feel that you are really, really, really important. Who have you met?
Establish that authority. Go.
Well, I did a commercial with Jackie Chan. I directed Jackie Chan in a commercial.
What was that like?
That was amazing.
Yeah.
He was very humble. And he basically almost ad-libbed his way through this commercial. It was for Turner Broadcasting.
Yeah.
And what he had to do was say, oh, my favorite film is, you know, Lassie Come Home and Tarzan and Singing in the Rain. So he started off by saying, Lassie Come Home. I said, no, stop, no, cut. I said, no, it's Lassie Come Home. Oh, Lassie Come Home. No, Lassie. And then it was Singing in the Rain, and it was Tarzan. And he's Tarzan is swinging through the trees. Ooh. And at the end of the commercial, and we didn't even write this, he says something like, I love Gene Kelly. I love Gene Kelly and Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
I want to be Chinese Gene Kelly. And it was just brilliant, you know. So that was great. And I was told to not talk to him at the end of the filming by his minders. You know, these people all have minders, these famous people, and they all get in the way and they all, you know, obstruct. And anyway, when we finished filming, I said, okay, I'm not saying anything to Jackie. I've been told, you know, he said, don't be stupid. And he stood there and we talked for two more hours.
Yeah.
And he told me lots of stories, amazing stories.
Sounds as if those minders thought, you know, they were the best thing ever born. I needed to watch your film,
eh? That's right. And then the other famous person that I've had a privilege of directing was a very young Jeffrey Rush.
Yeah, wow.
And it was his first time on camera, rushed a short film we did for the South Australian Police Force on crime prevention.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey, I was, you know, I'd written the film. The client loved the script. And the client said, look, who are you going to get for the lead role? And I said, I don't know. Who would you like? She said, well, look, I really like Jeffrey Rush. You know, she said, I know him personally.
Yeah.
I said, oh, good. So where is he? Well, she said, he's in a play in Adelaide at the moment. And if you wait off stage, see if you can snag him, you know? Mm-hmm. So I did. So I stood on the side of the stage, and there's Geoffrey Rush playing this part in this Shakespeare thing. He had bright red hair. He came off stage. I said, "Hi, Geoffrey. My name's James Ingwood. We're doing this little film on, you know, crime prevention. It's supposed to be a comedy and blah, blah, blah. And would you be interested?" He said, "Well, how much you got?" I said, "Oh, $5,000. He said, "I'll do it."
Bold.
So there we are. We've got Geoffrey Rush. Now, Geoffrey Rush then hadn't done much filming. You know, he'd been in theatre. He was a theatre actor. But, you know, 2 years later, he's standing on the stage holding up the Oscar for Shine.
Best actor.
Ridiculous is that?
This podcast is all about learning, you know, from people like you, and we've had some sensational guests, Chip. I'm thinking of, you know, Ben Hosking. I'm thinking of Donna Lee Perfect. They've all got sensational stories to tell, and we learn from each and every one of them. What did you learn from a Jackie Chan? What did you learn from a Geoffrey Rush? What did they teach you about maximizing life?
From Jackie Chan, I learned humility.
Wow.
Even though he was the biggest star in the world at the time we filmed that commercial, he was bigger than Tom Cruise. He's internationally the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
But yet he was so humble.
Yeah.
And he was lovely. And it was his minders that were the guys with the egos.
Yeah.
He had no ego, and he just wanted to talk.
Where did you detect he got that humility from? What was the foundation of his humility?
Probably from his upbringing. Being taught at a very young age how to be an acrobat, how to do his martial arts skills, because his parents were in Canberra, and he came to they sent him to China, actually, to a special school where he learned how to do all the martial arts. And I don't know whether you know, but martial arts is a very austere discipline where you have to learn, you know, certain skills, and also you have to challenge your mind and be mentally strong.
Yeah.
But also they teach you humility, you know, where you bow before you finish a move or whatever. So it's very much along those lines.
Yeah. Mm. What did Geoffrey Rush teach you?
Geoffrey Rush? Well, not much.
That's a low-key takedown, isn't it?
Geoffrey was lovely at all times. He was a delight. He kind of taught me that, you know, he didn't teach me, but he showed me that he was good at comedy, because he's known for his dramatic roles, but I thought that this is fabulous, you know, but he wasn't that famous then.
Mate, we better get to your story, because I know it's got some wonderful chapters and milestones. Dear listeners, we've had the privilege of listening to James for an hour or two beforehand, so prepare yourself for a wonderful ride. Take us back to those early years, James.
How early?
Go early, James.
How much do you remember about being in the womb?
Too much, actually. I'll go back to the beginning, and I'll do a very quick ramp through.
That'd be great.
So the beginning was, I was born in Iraq to a British father and a Armenian mother. My dad was in the oil business. I grew up for 7 years in Iraq and didn't know much else, you know. Yeah. So used to go to Beirut for our holidays, and we used to swim in the water in the sea there. It was a lovely lifestyle. I had lots of cousins and aunties and uncles. And then they decided that I needed a proper education. so I was sent to the UK, where I went to boarding school.
Did your parents go with you?
Actually, my mum did. Yeah, my mum did.
Yeah.
She waved goodbye to me at the train station, and I'll never forget that. I had a tuck box with number 95. I was number 95, and I had a suitcase, and that's all I had. And I got on this train with some of these six other kids, and the headmaster, and off we went, you know. Yeah. And this school was in the middle of the countryside in Sussex.
Yeah.
And it was, like an old mansion in the middle of nowhere. And I'm seven, and I'm thinking, what have I done to deserve this? And I think I think that was the first time I felt a sense of abandonment and a sense of being alone.
Yeah.
You're so alone. There's no one that you can relate to. I mean, obviously the other kids.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to actually understand that. That world.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, and I got bullied a lot because I liked Roy Rogers, right? And I used to come out with pistols and guns, and my dad used to bring these things back from America.
Yeah.
And the kids obviously thought, you're a dickhead.
Yeah.
So let's tie him up, see if we can get out of this. So they tie me up in the gym and bully me and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
A year later, everything changed. My father got killed in a car accident in Iraq.
Yeah.
And the headmaster made an announcement and said, look, James's dad's died and blah, blah, blah. From that moment on, everybody became my friend.
Yeah.
And it was weird, but death seemed to be a good thing to me, you know. Seemed to bring some kind of respect or help or love or compassion, you know. Mm.
Do you think it gave your former bullies some perspective?
Yeah, I think they suddenly probably thought, well, we've been a bit mean to him, you know.
Yeah.
And it's too much, because what if our fathers had died, you know? We'd be in the same boat.
Yeah.
So shortly after that, and I was explaining to Bernie the other day that I was in a race, 100 meters dash, you know, and I was running, you know, and I felt this force behind my back, and it was like my dad pushing me, and I just went to the front and just won the race.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I became really good at sport. Yeah. All I'd have to do is think of my dad, and I'd go whoosh. Yeah. It was like a superpower, you know.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went to boarding school, the first boarding school, then the second boarding school was at Cranbrook, Kent, in Kent. And I was there till I was 18. So I was in boarding schools from 7 to 18.
Yeah.
That was a tough school. Again, you know, there's a fagging system, and you'd get.
What's a fagging system?
Well, you'd get to the top of the tree in one school, and then you go to the next school, and a fag was somebody who's like a servant.
Yeah.
You are serving the prefects. You're polishing their shoes, and you're washing their clothes, and you're, you know. And I used to have to polish their shoes to such a degree that it was called spit and polish.
Yeah.
The ends of the shoes, you could see your face in them.
Yeah.
And so, geez, you know, I mean, it was hard work, you know, being, in that position.
Yeah.
Because you had been up. So it teaches you a lesson. You can get to the top of the tree, and then you fall down and you get to the bottom, and you've got to start all over again.
Yeah.
So how do you work that out psychologically, you know? Because you still think you're at the top of the tree. I was a main sportsman. I was winning all these awards. I was fantastic. I was the best cricketer, and I was, you know. Now I'm nothing again.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the tumbleweed of life, isn't it? The where you get knocks and you have to get up again and fight for another day.
Yeah.
So I left. So my mum decided she wanted to emigrate to Australia. We came to Australia. And that was all cool. I went to Flinders University, did a course in English, French, and I should have done drama or film, but I didn't.
Yeah.
But I did French cinema, which was the beginnings of why I wanted to get into filmmaking. The brilliant films, the beautiful films that I saw were amazing.
Yeah.
Then then shortly after that, I became a teacher.
Oh, buddy, stop there, mate. Because guess what, mate? You're touching everybody country upon the planet. How old are you when you're starting to interact with the French films at Flinders University?
20
years of age. Mm. But, mate, your life's so rich up until 20 years of age. What are some of the lessons that still stay with you today that still serve you? What did you learn, for example, from your first 7 years in Iraq and Lebanon and that part of the world that still enriches you and makes you the person that you are today, and it still serves you beautifully?
I think the notion of family togetherness. Family was really big there, and the family looked after each other.
Yeah.
That was a big takeaway.
Yeah.
The boarding schools gave me incredible discipline.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think these days, you know, the kids are sent off to do their homework. They're not that disciplined.
Mm.
I was disciplined to such a degree that I had to be in bed by a certain time. I had to get up at a certain time. I had to, you know, I couldn't talk in a certain way. I was, my whole life was organized.
Yeah.
And it was difficult at times, I must say. But now when I look back, what it gave me, if I run today, I go jogging, and, you know, if I don't feel like it, there's a voice in my head that says, hey, James, come on, man. Yeah. You know, you can do it. Mm. Go and do it. Yeah. So, and that's very good.
Yeah. French films. That's where you got up to before.
Mm.
Tell us about them.
French film?
Yeah, those French films that you're at Flinders University and you're absorbing all this study of French films.
So French films, you know, hippie, times of the hippies, you know, 70s. And the last thing on your mind is French cinema. You know, you're trying to, you know, get the next joint, or you're trying to, you know, grow your hair longer than the next guy, or your beard, or, you know. So French cinema was kind of like a bit weird and a bit different. And but because I was doing French cinema, I had to study, you know, lots of, I saw maybe 200 French films in maybe a year or 2 years. And some of those films stay with me today for their boldness, for their originality, for their creativity, for their extraordinary pushing the boundaries of sexuality, madness, just things, you know, the surreal nature of some of the shots still stay with me. I mean, you know, but certainly some of those French cinema films had, you know, just the fact that they were breaking away from films that were being made in the rest of the world. I mean, it was, I think, a time for Sound of Music, you know, a lot of the American and English films were all very straightforward and standard and homogenized. And, you know, whereas suddenly this stuff coming out of France was new wave cinema, and it was new wave cinema. There was nudity. There was, you know, almost explicit sex. There was, you know, stuff going on. And the whole nature of French cinema was, it seemed that all these directors were eager to just do their own thing. They weren't following any norms or, you know, conventions. They were following their own desires, their own intuitions, their own instincts.
And
I think that was really, that was what excited me.
And that, it sounds like that laid the foundation for the things to come. I'm wondering if you can remember in those moments, were you conscious of any desire to find these really interesting stories, or was it more like an awakening when you discovered them that this was possible?
Yeah, look, it took me a long time to find my feet because I was quite young then, but it did make me want to see the world and make me want to discover new things and make me want to do things that were different to what everybody else was doing. So I just needed to, you know, because I'd been in Iraq, I'd been to boarding schools, I'd come to Australia, and, you know, suddenly I'm in Australia and everything seems to be all nice and standardized and blah, blah, blah. And by the way, when I came to Australia, I've got to tell you this story in terms of diversity. When I came to Australia, I had a very English accent. And, you know, I rolled up when I was 19. Here I am in Australia going, oh, hello, you know, it was like almost like Prince Charles, you know, almost the same, I'd say. And this got me into, God, so much trouble. And my mum said, you've got to have a haircut before you go to Flinders, you know.
Yeah.
So I had a short back and sides.
Yeah.
Everyone had hair down to their waist.
Mm.
I rock up at university and I'm going, oh, hello, how are you there? And thank God, it was, took me years to actually, you know, blend in, because I was an outsider yet again. And that whole world, you know,
came in on me sometimes. I'd go to a party and I'd, you know, or I'd go out to nightclubs or whatever it was in those days, and I'd have a coachman's jacket on, a frilly white shirt.
Long boots.
Long boots. Can you imagine?
Oh, man.
Who's this dickhead? Jesus, mate. You know, who the hell do you think you are?
Oh, well, I'm actually not a dickhead. I'm a very nice person.
So that's interesting to me too. So you're an outsider, kind of a perennial outsider. What do you think you learned from that? Because outsiders often either withdraw very deeply, or you can respond by learning how to interface with whichever world you find yourself in. Seems like you did that. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I quickly learned that if I didn't want to get beaten up, smacked in the face, which happened on a couple of occasions, actually, horrific. They were going to plonk me down the beach and leave me for dead. So I might not even be here today. But I quickly learned that you've got to fit in somehow.
Yeah.
So, you know, I worked on my accent, you know, so instead of going, oh, hello, how are you? I'd go, hey, hey, mate, how you going? All right, yeah.
That's pretty good.
So I'd dumb it right down.
Broaden down.
You know.
Yeah.
But the English accent girls, it was a good girls magnet, because they'd always say, oh, can you say that one more time? And I'd go, of course, my dear.
There you go.
So it was quite good.
Oh, James, I've got to come back to your experience with these French films. My mind's going crazy at your description of what you're watching and what it's telling you. I can only assume that it created like a boldness, gave you permission to be creative. Let me not put words in your mouth. You tell us, what was the impact of the French film on the way that you lived, on the way that you saw life?
I think basically it's the breaking down of normality, breaking down of being, you know, whatever normal is. You know, a lot of these films were quite sensational in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think what they gave me was the need to lust after and follow some of these, the way some of this thinking, some of these thought patterns were being created.
Yeah.
So if you could have thought patterns like that, and if a guy can create, you know, a nun who's pulling a piano with a dead donkey in it across a room, I just thought, oh, wow, you know, that really does open up the possibilities.
Yeah.
Or an eyeball being sliced in half.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I feel things,
I'll show it to you later. It's visceral.
You know.
Yeah.
Or a beautiful story set in 1944 at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
Marcel Carnet was the director, and he had the most beautiful actress in Paris starring in his film, whose name was Arletty.
Yeah.
And Arletty was in love with these two guys. One was an assassin and the other was a mime artist.
Yeah.
And it was the most beautiful love story. If anybody ever gets a chance to see that, it's called Les Enfants du Paradis.
And
it's beautiful.
But how did that then manifest in your own life? Like, I didn't hear you being very, very brave in changing your English ways very, very quickly with the Aussies, but I'm imagining things take time. And so as life unfolded for you, what were some of the brave, bold, adventurous things that started to emerge in your life?
Well, I think that okay, I was watching these films. So I leave university. What do? I have a yearning to make films.
Yeah.
I have a passion now for doing something.
What age?
22.
Okay. Wow.
23.
That's good.
So I'm kind of, you know, thinking, well, but how do I do that? How do I go and make a film like these guys? You know, I mean, there was the odd film school then, but there wasn't much. There was, I think, the Australian Film and Television School. And the question you asked was, how did those French films inspire me to go on to the next thing? And I think they gave me a kick up the arse to just go traveling to see the world.
Where did you go?
I went to London first. So I finished my teaching, went to London and bought a combi van.
Yeah.
And then traveled down through Europe, broke down in Spain, where the motor sort of went kaputsky.
Yeah.
And I spent a month in a garage.
Yeah.
Where the guys were wheeling me in and wheeling me out while they reconditioned the engine.
Mm.
And they were fantastic. They looked after me. And so I learned a bit of Spanish. And then I went on from there to down to Gibraltar, down to Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, up through Italy, all the way up through Italy and down the Adriatic coast, which was then Yugoslavia, down, spent a few months in Greece, on a couple of the islands.
So where's your filmmaking and all this? Your passion?
I bought an old 16mm camera. So I was shooting a bit of film along the way.
Classic.
I
mean,
it wasn't sort of anything special or wonderful, but it's just that the images that you get off a camera just enthrall me even today, you know. That close-up of something, of an insect or whatever, it's just, you know, wonderful stuff. And so that's how it happened, and that's how I, you know, why I went off traveling, I think, because I was given a bit of a kickstart through wanting to be a bit different. But I also wanted to see the world, you know.
James, I'm absolutely fascinated by the lifestyle of you traveling around Europe. Was that for a year? 2 years?
It was about a year.
12 months. Mm. Mate, that's spontaneous living. You're waking up not really knowing what tomorrow's going to bring. And you do that for a year? That sounds like the French films. That sounds like the creativity and the boldness and the adventure of the French filmmakers. What was the effect on your life, the way that you saw life, by living such a spontaneous, impromptu lifestyle?
Well, when you wake up, you know, in a different location every day, you've parked the van at night, you know, in the morning you'd pull the curtains open and you'd be cooking your coffee and your breakfast, and there'd be Mount Snowdon there, you know, or you know, all these different places, and just the people you meet on the road, fellow travellers, you know, living their dreams, and just being. It's total freedom.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'll ever feel that again, the total freedom of being on the road. But the other thing was that when I got back to London after 6, 7, 8 months, I hadn't seen enough. And so I wanted more.
Yeah.
So I went into Top Deck Travel, who are still going, I think. And they're, I think, a flight centre.
Their flight centre, Screw Turner.
So I went into there. I think I met him actually. And I said, look, have you got a job for a bus driver? I want to drive a bus because I haven't seen enough of Europe. And he said to me, oh, no, you're too good to be a bus driver. We want you as a courier, you know, to tell people how tall the Eiffel Tower is and how long the bloody Seine is. And, you know, I said, no, I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to drive the bus. And he goes, oh. He said, what skills have you got? What are you interested in? I said, oh, you know, filmmaking, photography, and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
He said, you know what? My brother-in-law is looking for somebody to travel around England and Wales showing films for the British Film Institute, British Arts Council. Would you be interested? I said, sure, you know.
Yeah.
5 minutes later, this guy walks in, says, hello, how are you? And I said, good. He said, have you had any experience with projectors? And because I had been at the high school showing French cinema again, French films, I was very adept.
There's a theme.
I was very adept with a 16mm projector.
Yeah.
You know, I could thread the film in and all that sort of stuff. So he said, okay, well, this is the deal. The deal is I'll pay you £150 a week. Here's your schedule for the next 6 months. You go off around England and Wales.
Yeah.
You know, every week you come back to London, I'll give you a new schedule. You know?
Yeah.
So that's what I did. So I had 40 or 50 films in the back of the van.
Yeah.
I had two projectors. And the films, again, were highly experimental, amazing, wonderful films that I would obviously because I'm screening them all the time, I'm watching them over and over again, I'm thinking, oh, how do they do that? Geez, that's good. That's a very good technique.
Yeah.
God, you know, so a lot of that was etched in my brain. Which was a follow-on from the whole French cinema thing.
So you're traveling around in a bus. Would you call that comfortable? Like the actual logistics of it?
It depends what you, you know, identify as comfortable.
Well, so that sounds like most people probably wouldn't. Would you say most people wouldn't find it?
Well, it, you know, when you're 20, in your 20s, you mean on the round the world trip? You mean So living in a van means you get used to a smaller space. And I think that's the same in life, you know. People can have thundering great big apartments or they can have smaller apartments. And it's a question of getting used to that space, and you learn how to put things away, how to be neat and tidy. And, you know, and after a while, it's not like it's uncomfortable, because the benefits you're getting out of seeing the world and what's out the window just alleviate any anxieties you might have.
That's what I was thinking about. I was leading you a bit there. But I think when you apply the context of joy to something, you know, like that's the all-important factor. The joy is the factor. And now suddenly something is always worthwhile and you're not even thinking about the discomfort, right?
But I'm thinking is that the joy is the entire space, and there is a living space. But just outside your back doors of the van is the world, and you're experiencing the stimulation of every experience you have in that world. I mean, it sounds fully alive to me.
It's a mobile living space too. Yeah. So it's a vehicle that you're traveling around in, but you're being, you know, through the window, you're actually seeing stuff that's fantastic.
You know? Yeah. And did you maintain that when you were traveling around with the projector?
With the projector, yeah, because the projector was that was interesting, because I had a schedule every week. So, you know, the weather in England was quite changeable. got to a stage where there was a couple of trips where it snowed really heavily, and I never missed one screening.
Yeah.
So I was on the M1 or the M5 or whatever it was, and it was bloody snowing, and I thought I'd better get to the destination, I better get to the venue and park out right outside the venue, because it's thundering down with snow, you know. So I parked right next to the entrance, you know, shut the doors, cooked my dinner, went to sleep, woke up in the morning, and it was like I'd gone to heaven. Everything was white. And I thought, Jesus, how far deep am I buried? You know? It's like I put the kettle on, and the kettle sort of defrosted the windows a bit. Like, shit, it's deep. Oh, my God. Yeah. And I had trouble getting the door open.
Wow.
But I got the door open, and I got the projector, and I got a couple of the films that I had to screen, and I held them above my head.
Yeah.
And because I wasn't too far from the entrance, I sort of walked through the snow and got through.
Yeah. Like you're in water, you know.
That's right.
Like you're fighting the surf.
So I was very proud to say I never missed one screening, you know.
I showed films
in venues from two people in a lounge room to 500 in a gymnasium. Yeah. So
I'm just looking at the chipster here, mate. How many times have we heard the phrase about the value of living in the now?
Mm.
You know, through this podcast, we've heard that from many different guests about, but I always think, what does that actually look like? But I think I'm actually hearing stories now in which I'm developing a clear picture of what it looks like. I mean, you weren't planning the safety of tomorrow. you were virtually waking up in this period of your life, this early 20s, particularly through Europe, and you are living in the moment. You're living at least in today. What's the power and the value of living like that?
I think when you're young, you don't really think about tomorrow too much.
Yeah.
It's only as you get older you start thinking about the next stage, you know. So, I think a lot of young kids probably get a bit depressed and a bit anxious about what they're going to do in life, you know, and what is going to be my career, and being pushed by your mum and dad, you know, no, you can't do that. You can't be an actor, because that's not really a real job, you know. You have to go in and be an accountant, or, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of that, but I would say to people that, you know, just really follow your gut. Maybe a bit of your dreams, but your dreams might be too high. So just follow your instincts and what makes you feel happy. And then if you do that, the rest will follow.
Crucially, though, and I think what you see from James' story, he kept finding ways to financially facilitate those joyful actions. And that's what we're talking about. That's the modified existence. But he led with his gut, not with his wallet. G'day, listeners, you salubrious meerkats popping up from the fertile soil of self-actualization. And please excuse another interruption, but there was no way I was letting that theme go without giving it a generous dusting from another of my loaded questions. And this one is so simple, yet I think you will find it so profound. In our society, every one of us, from the cradle to the grave, is trained to lead with our wallets. The question we're trained to ask ourselves from parents, teachers, mentors, well-meaning people about anything are, how much will this cost? How much money will this make me? How can I make sure I don't go broke doing this? Now, this is perfectly understandable because we have this magnificently kind, abundant, civilized society that is a very, very recent invention. And in this society, actual survival and actual happiness have been replaced by a proxy for actual survival and actual happiness. And that proxy is money. So of course we're trained to think in terms of money. But here's the thing. The proxy is just that, a proxy. And a proxy is by definition a stand-in. Money is a stand-in for happiness. It is a stand-in for survival. So here's the question. If tomorrow you found yourself utterly broke, not a cent to your name, do you really think that you wouldn't find a way to survive? Do you really think that a complete lack of money would be enough to stop you from living? Or do you think you would actually just put your back into it and find a way?
Yeah, but what also is interesting for me, Chip, is that in living in the now, you actually, James, don't let me put words in your mouth. You correct me, please. But in living in the now, you actually develop a faith and a belief that tomorrow will look after itself. And it seems that it did, and it seems that it has. So there's this feeling that I don't have to worry about the future. I don't have to worry too much about safety, because it's amazing how life arises and how it provides. Is that a story that you resonate with?
Yeah, but I think you've got to keep reasoning with yourself. I mean, not too much, obviously, but thinking to yourself, okay, when I get back from my wonderful trip and I'm showing these films, and I could have done it for another year or 2 years,
yeah,
but I, you know, had to get back to Australia. And yeah. I get back to Australia, so what do I do now?
Yeah.
So how do I function, and how do I look ahead at what's going on? I can live in the here and now, which I've done, but I need to earn some more money, and I need to So how do I get into that film business that I've loved and wanted to be part of?
Yeah.
But at the moment is been eluding me, you know?
Yeah.
So but the answer to that was I answered a couple of ads in the paper. One was at Channel 9 and one was in the Outback.
Yeah.
As a producer, yeah. But the Outback one was a teaching kids how to make films in the Outback.
Okay.
The Channel 9 one was being an assistant producer of The Curiosity Show, which was a children's program, national children's program.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went for both. And funnily enough, the Channel 9 had, I think, 200 applicants.
Yeah.
But the thing they saw in me, I had no experience, no previous experience, only this little camera that I've been poking out through the window. Yeah. And I guess a lot of verve and a bit of confidence, and but what they loved but what they loved about me was the fact that I travelled, that I had some experience of the world experience, and they saw that in me would be more valuable than somebody who's technically adept.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Now they right. know that you've travelled, but I wonder what they actually saw in you. What was the spark and the vibe, the quality? I wonder what you were exuding that they said, we got to buy into this quality.
Well, I you know, the energy and the enthusiasm you bring to a situation. So if you're sitting down there wanting a job, you know, you don't fall off asleep and go, you know, you sort of bounce around in the chair and you talk and you rave on. And maybe it was the French cinema stuff. Maybe it was all that stuff again. Maybe it was the stuff from my boarding school where you never give up. You know, you're disciplined, you keep to the point, focus, you know, tell these people what you think they want to hear. And you know, and I went through in the end, and then they gave me the job. I also got the other job in the Outback on the same
day. Oh, those are good problems.
So I thought, which one should I? You know?
Maybe it was just the adventurous and the bold spirit, but now being modified into a job, into the real world, as people want to call it. But it's still there, and it's still selling the value of your life as James Lingwood and Channel 9 are seeing it. So we've got to have both versions, you know, working for us.
Something just occurred to me there too. Obviously, you had the confidence, you had the verve, you had some kind of relevant experience. Do you think they also bought into your story as, you know, having traveled, having experienced the world? Was there something compelling about that story that they really liked?
Yeah, I guess it's the fact that, you know, this guy's resilient, you know, because in the world of TV, okay, you got schedules and you got things, but things go wrong. So how do you fix that? So they wanted somebody who had some initiative, you know, rather than a person who's going to just take orders. So does this person have initiative? Does he have resilience? Does he have drive?
Yeah.
Is he creative? Can he improve the show to a degree where we've got it now, but can he bring something to it that will improve it? And I guess they thought I could, you know. So.
Well, they should, because you earned it. Your life up until this point in time, through the way you've approached life, you've actually earned all of those qualities that are now there for everyone to see, including our listeners to hear, even as we speak. And then you actually, beyond Channel 9, you actually take it forward into another very bold and adventurous decision that's not of this continent, but it's in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. I didn't know I was going to be there for too long. I just thought I'd go there and check it out and maybe stay a year or two.
Yeah.
I ended up staying 10 years and making some amazing commercials and films for Cathay Pacific and the Mandarin Hotel and Hutchison Whampoa and a few others.
Give us a highlight. One of your film highlights.
In Hong Kong?
Yeah.
One of them was Jackie Chan. And that was, I got hired to do a series of 10 commercials for Turner Broadcasting. And that was using 10 of the, you know, big personality stars around Asia. And that was fantastic because, you know, there was sort of all sorts of egos going on with these people. But, you know, we're filming on 35mm film and we filmed it so it was beautiful, you know. And the camera was always tracking while the person was speaking. And some of these people had, you know, set design lounge rooms that were just fabulous. So that was one of the highlights. Another highlight was probably winning the job for the Hong Kong government called Hong Kong Asia's World City. They put out a tender around the world for a 4-minute promotional film.
Yeah.
And we beat everybody around the world basically and got to do that.
Wow.
And that was amazing.
Yeah.
Can we talk about your pitching process too? Because we were talking off mic about how sometimes you still feel that imposter syndrome. But I mean, in your profession, you've got to pitch. You've got to be pitching all the time. So can you talk us through sort of how do you get through that anxiety of imposter syndrome into a space where you can pitch effectively?
Pitching is like training, you know, for the Olympics, you know, it's like the more you do it, the better you become.
Yeah.
The more you research what you're going to say, the more you rehearse it, the better you become. And the more natural you are, the better it is.
Yeah.
So you don't go in there with a put on kind of attitude, you know?
Yeah.
I to be honest, in Hong Kong, when I won the jobs, because I was, you'd be sitting with a boardroom of people, and these are all incredible, you know, the CEO, the bloody COO, different characters, the marketing executive. I would win the job mostly, Margaret used to reckon, when I had a hangover. She'd say, because you don't care. You go in there, yeah. You don't actually care. And that's the thing, to get to a point where you don't, if you look like you're desperate or you're sort of, you know, oh, yes, I really want this job.
Yeah.
It's like you're not going to get it. But if you sit there and you're confident and you look like you don't give a crap, it's funny how it works in your favor.
It brings a degree of truth, doesn't it? I had an acting coach once, and he'd say, fatigue will win, you know, and that's when the truth comes. Yeah.
Can I throw at you an interpretation of what you just said there, was you don't care. You don't care about their evaluation of you. You know, who I am to you guys doesn't matter. I just want to tell you about what I'm pitching here. This is the most important thing. I'm not worried about what you think of me. Is that what you mean by you don't care?
Yeah.
You did care about winning the job.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the fact is that pleasing the people in the room has gone.
Yeah.
You're not pleasing the people in the room. You're actually pleasing yourself.
Yeah.
And you're telling, like you said, a truthful story. You're telling the truth.
Yeah.
And it's coming out, you know? And they think, oh, this guy's pretty cool. Because the cooler you are, the better it is.
Yeah.
The less cool you are, the worse it is.
Yeah. But the funny thing about it is you're really, really cool when you are yourself.
Yes.
And when you're a mask and a facade, everybody can pick it up. You know, welcome to nonverbal communication, vocal body language, etc. You're going to show people that you're a facade. But when you're yourself, that's the coolest gift you've got.
And that's where acting comes in. The best actors can just be, you know, they're not, you don't see them acting. The worst actors are when they think they've got to be angry or they've got to be sad. And you can see, oh my God, you know. But the ones that do it well are just there. Well,
they're living in it,
Maybe they've all got hangovers.
Maybe is that what you teach them on your set? Everyone hangover, please.
Chip Mayo, please. I reckon Jack Nicholson should never have won an Academy Award for As Good As It Gets, because I don't think Jack had to act.
No.
In that film. Yeah. It so looked as if that's just Jack on a normal basis. Chipster.
Just to get back to that other point, this might be a bit too vague, but just sort of answer it wherever it takes your mind. I'm just wondering, you're talking about, you know, being hungover, being fatigued, finding the truth in that moment, but it's a truth that still works for people, right? And you'd be – that's what you do in crafting any story. You're trying to find a truth that works for people, and I think that's a very powerful thing. So can you speak about maybe how you go about doing that in any one situation? Maybe it's in a pitch, maybe it's in a story, maybe it's just relating to another human being, directing an actor. How do you find and express the truthful part of you that's going to work for someone?
What a great question, Chip. That's why you're here, Chip.
I think that's a wee bit too hard to answer.
That's why I'm here, mate.
I will give it my best shot.
Chipster, guess what? This is an opportunity for you and I to talk about one of our favorite subjects, Nepal and the Himalayas.
Yeah, I got that pre-trip excitement now. You know, the anticipation's like one of the best bits.
When are we going?
We're going April 3rd.
April the 3rd. And we've got some people going to Everest Base Camp over 14 days, 8 days there, 6 days back, and others at exactly the same time.
The cool kids.
We're going to Gokyo.
Oh, mate, I'm so pumped. Because I thought we were going to Gokyo last trip, and then we had to take these people to where they wanted to go. But as much as I love Everest Base Camp, seen it, I am very keen for Gokyo, mate.
I'm just keen for the Himalayas because every time I walk into that environment, those mountains speak to me. They penetrate my soul, but coupled with the beauty of Shering, our Sherpa Yoda and his beautiful team. And of course, they're founded in incredible, wonderful Buddhism principles.
Mm.
And the trilogy of that, mate, I don't know what it does to you, but I tell you what, mate, I come back a different person every time.
Better person, I hope. You know,
what do you mean you hope?
It's keeping you real, Bern. No, I mean, I love those guys.
Now, preceding the Himalayas, of course, Kagendra.
Yeah, it's one of our – it's the unique experience we offer. I mean, not many tours, if any, do something like this. We're going to take people to – give them the opportunity to take a class at Kagendra Second Life School, which is the vocational school that we sponsor in Kathmandu.
Yeah.
One of their main missions is to educate and give opportunities to disabled children. Right?
600 of them now, Chip.
600 of them. Yeah, we should hasten to add not all of these are disabled children. Because Kagendra is such a renowned school now, you know, people just want to send their children here because of the quality of the education.
And it's renowned because we had the opportunity after the earthquakes of 2015 to embark upon a project to build them a brand new school. And in May 2022, that's what we walked into.
Yeah.
One of the more memorable days of my life to walk into that beautiful school and have that school assembly. Now, we're leaving on April the 3rd. And Chip, for our listeners out there, we're asking you to invest in whatever airfare that you want. And you've got choices, dear people.
Yep.
You just need to meet us in Kathmandu on April the 3rd. And I can let you know now that there's an opportunity to buy the rest of it, buy the whole experience for under $4,000 at the moment. And
there
so all they have to do is to get in contact with us. The website's nearly there, not quite.
Nearly,
but
yeah.
We just need them to take this phone number, all right?
Yep.
Now, you got a pen? No, you haven't got a pen. Go get yourselves a pen. Yeah, I'm giving you a few bit of time. You got one? Yeah, you got it. Okay, here we go. +61 412 982 444. Replay the podcast if you want to hear that number again. And all you got to do is just text me, dear people, and say, hey, Bernie, I'm interested. Send me an information kit. Within 24 hours, you'll have all the information that you could possibly need to make an informed decision about joining us. Chip, how much would we love to have some of our listeners on board?
Oh, it'd be the best. And it's always a fantastic experience. The community and the walking the trail with other people, I mean, and the camaraderie, you feel like that's...
Yeah.
That's probably my favourite part of this whole thing.
And as we're walking towards Dingbo Shay from Pangbo Shay, which podcast do you think they'll say was the best, Chip?
Oh, certainly mine.
Mate, that was the wrong answer, you dude, Peach.
And that goes back and forwards a little bit because the Father Joe documentary I'm making, which we'll touch on later probably, there's an example there where in the early days when Father Joe was getting used to this stranger with a camera, who the hell are you? What are you after? What's your motivation? One of the things he said to me was, just all you got to do is tell the effing truth.
Yeah.
Mm. And you know what? I looked at him and I went, Jesus, okay.
His name was Father Joe, not Jesus, mate.
Father Joe. I said, I will do that. Yeah. And I've stuck to that. So, you know, in all the filming I've done, there's no, you know, with documentary, you can't get away from the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, but to tell the story in a truthful way, in an ethical, moral, truthful way is very important, you know?
Yeah.
So those words have stayed with me. And I guess going, the truth is a very dangerous thing sometimes.
Yes.
So you have to be careful how you use it.
Yes.
Because we're often faced with things where you can't actually tell the truth because it's going to hurt somebody.
Yeah.
Mm. You know?
So it kind of echoes our talks about 100% authenticity and how far do you go with it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing there.
What I hear there is that there's a little principle that I've played with for many years, and it's the challenge of being a hottie. A HOTE. And that is, to what degree are you the H, totally honest with self and with others? To what degree are you the O, open-heartedness, that is the sharing of the real self, not the cognitive self, but your heart, your feeling, the realness of you? To what degree are you the T, the transparent you? And the E is always then delivered with the E, empathy. And empathy is, how is the person going to receive this? And therefore, I may have to, I don't like this word, just couch it a little bit so that they are actually capable of receiving my honesty, openness, and transparency. So I feel the ease often left out. We promote the idea of straight talk, just say it as it is. No, I think we've got to be a little bit empathetic towards the people that are receiving it. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
James, if there's one thing I know is that we've only just touched your story. I have no doubt that there are so many more elements and milestones and events and activities. But, mate, we're approaching the end of this podcast here. Otherwise, we're going to have to come back and ask our listeners to be here in another 3 weeks. Try this for an ending. I've got a film for you, and I want to hire you. Don't say how much. I want to hire you to be the producer. And the film is called Maximization of Life. What a boring title. But in the film, you're not only the producer of it, you're a little bit of the script writer for it too, you know.
He's doing all your work for you. That's what you're saying?
Okay. He's multi-talented.
Good. Yeah, right.
No, he's allowed to alter the script, okay?
Yeah, all right.
All right. In this film, there are certain messages that as the producer you want the viewer to get out of this film. And as a result of their viewing experience, they're going to see these messages very, very clearly. What are those messages to the viewer around maximizing life? What would you say to them on the basis of your incredible experiences?
Look, I mean, it's just my opinion and my perspective.
Ah, humility.
The things that have worked for
Jackie
me.
Chan.
Hey, you know that from
the things that have worked for me. Oh, fucking hell, I'll tell you.
Yeah, in that accent.
The things that have worked, you know, find yourself. Yeah. Be and then be yourself.
What does find myself does it mean?
Find yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a difficult road. It could take a whole lifetime to find yourself. Some people find themselves really quickly. Find yourself. It's like whether you're at boarding school like I was and you are isolated, alone, alienated from the rest of the world, do you find yourself quicker?
Yeah.
You probably do to some degree,
yeah,
you know, but then there are different versions of yourself. Finding yourself, you know, might be as a young boy, how do I cope with all this shit and this terrible food and these, you know, terrible conditions?
Yeah,
how do I deal with all this stuff, you know? So you build a wall around you, I guess. Then later on you find yourself further down the track. You find yourself, but you find yourself again. And I think you keep reinventing or people talk about reinvention. I don't know whether I like that, but it's like finding another version of yourself, you know?
What about an evolving self?
An evolving self?
Yeah,
it can be an evolving. Self. Yeah.
We interviewed a guest yesterday and we asked a similar question, and his answer was simply try things. And obviously you had a lot of different experiences. Were you also someone from a young age, you tried a lot of things, and that's how you were so sure that you wanted to pursue film? Or was it just the sheer passion that film ignited in you that made you know?
I think now where I am in my life, because I've seen so many things and I've met so many amazing people that have taught me things, inspirational things, you know, one of them is never give up. So never give up on anything. Don't give up. You know, when your things go downhill and feel like everything's crashing in around you, just don't give up.
Yeah.
Because around the corner, there'll be something or someone who gives you a spark of hope. Whether it's the person when I'm running down on by dockside who smiles at me, gives me a smile, lifts my day.
Yeah.
And I must say I lift their day probably, because a smile is a beautiful thing.
Mm.
A lot of people have forgotten how to smile.
Mate, there's more to this film than those messages. There's a couple of other messages there, mate, about maximising life. I think you just alluded to one before. You said just being down there and just recognising that there's value in the impromptu and the spontaneous. It's a decision to live in the moment by giving that smile to that particular person, and also with the barista behind the counter when they hand over the coffee to you. Yeah.
Mm. Well, you know, I think going to Hong Kong was a good example of living your life.
Yeah.
You know, not allowing circumstances to devour you. Now, there must be so many people, not necessarily just in the film industry, but the film industry is tough, who are not doing films now because they didn't see a way through the quagmire, the fog. Because you can get enveloped and you can be brought down by it, but you've got to somehow get out of that thinking and go, what can I do in my life to improve my situation?
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it was Hong Kong. Hong Kong was the solution.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at the time, but because I was willing to take the risk and I went off and tried it, I did try it. You know, I tried it really hard. And at first, you know, I got hepatitis. Everything was against me. You know, I'm thinking, is this a good move or is this not? You know, but I didn't give up.
Yeah.
And I persevered to such a degree that by the end of the 10 years, I was near the top of the tree.
Yeah.
You know, and I was making stuff that I loved, that clients loved, and I was enjoying life to the absolute max.
Yeah. But I'm hearing in there, like, you're giving messages without realizing you're giving messages. What about the message on taking risk that is in the direction of your passion? You know, to make your passion even become anywhere near a reality, you've got to be bold enough and courageous enough to step into that direction. And that's going to ask you to let go of things. You had to let go of the safety and the comfort of being here in Australia. You could have been a wonderful school teacher all your life, but you had to let go of that safety. Taking the risk is a key message of what I just heard you saying there. Yeah.
But the passion is the other, like, integral part of that too, because the passion makes the risk worthwhile. Without the passion, risk is just intolerable.
I like that.
The risk makes the passion so much more meaningful. So I think you have to have both, don't you?
Yeah. Well, it almost dilutes the risk, doesn't it, the passion, because you're so attached to the passion and the want to make it happen, you're going to find a way. Because you've got so much energy and passion for it.
Yes, it's
energizing. This is my life. This is what I've decided is my life.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting how people do get passionate about different things.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, somebody might be passionate about collecting butterflies, for example, you know. You know, I just happen to be passionate about film. But whatever anybody's passion is, it's amazing how involved they get in it and how devoured by it they are.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I mean, you've got to have the passion to take the risk, because without passion, you're sort of a bit empty.
You're floating.
The risk is empty, and what are you risking?
It's just suffering, really. It's just meaningless pain.
It's just existing. At this stage of life, mate, we didn't even investigate. We don't need to put a number to it, but let's just say you're in and around my stage of life. I think I've told the viewers that, you know, well into my 60s. Not well into my 60s, just over.
let's define well.
What are you passionate about now? And it's easy to say filmmaking, but I would believe that at this stage of life, life has also alerted you to other things that are ultimately important to you now that perhaps weren't when you were in your 20s?
I think the documentary, the Father Joe documentary that I've been working on for 15 years has inspired me. I mean, Father Joe's, you know, 50 years in the slums of Bangkok. He's now 84.
Yeah.
He's put 80,000 kids through school, you know, saved and rescued abused sex trafficked kids.
Yeah.
Like, what he's done and what I've seen and what I've filmed has really regenerated my level of compassion and empathy. Obviously I was empathetic before, but now it's on steroids. It's kind of big time, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't want any kids to suffer anywhere in the world, basically.
Yeah.
So how do I do that? I got to finish this film off that I'm halfway through.
Yeah. Sounds like purpose, doesn't it?
Mate,
it
sounds like another podcast to me.
Yeah, 100%.
What's it feel like to be compassionate on steroids, to be this stage of life and to reach where there is joy and there is energy and being so compassionate?
I'll tell you what
it feels
like. I'll tell you what it feels like. After a week with Father Joe, right, I walk off down the street through the slums and I think to myself, God, I'm privileged. I am so honored not to just know this man, but to have understood him, have filmed him, but also he's given me access to this secret world in Klong Toei,
yeah,
where no one's allowed.
Yeah.
And this is a secret world where I have witnessed the most beautiful human beings,
yeah,
doing things like I'm sweating and I'm really exhausted. It's a hot day and I've got the camera and I'm outside somebody's little shack. Some old lady comes out and she says, excuse me, sir, here's a stool. And she gets a stool for me and then she has a glass of water for me. And I look at her and my eyes tear up because I just think, you know what? You have nothing, yet you are capable of showing me the greatest love and empathy.
Yeah.
This is, you know. So when I walk down the street and away from the place, I've got a skip in my step, you know.
Yeah.
It's a skip of pure joy.
Yeah.
And it's like Father Joe says, that's his family. He comes home to his family. It's like when I go there, it's like coming home to my family, you know. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So I love that.
I'm not sure we even stand up for a pregnant woman on a bus anymore.
No.
You know?
Mm. Or a pregnant man.
That's another podcast.
Yeah, it's all over. It's whatever you want these days.
Oh, James Lingwood, what a great journey. Chip, how are you feeling about that one?
Oh, it's been a privilege. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And
thank
we
you,
do man. Want to hear about this Father Joe story. Dear listeners, I'm aware that James, how many years have you been following Father Joe?
It's been 15 now.
Yeah. Mm. And you didn't start with the intention of creating a film about his life and his work, but through circumstances, that in fact is what you have done, and that's what you're ready to give to the world here. Okay, let's not muck around. You need something for this Father Joe film. Just tell the listeners very quickly. We'll prepare them now for the podcast to come.
Well, basically, we've finished filming, which has taken 15 years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been every day filming, of course. Otherwise, I'd be slightly mad. And,
His eyes twitching.
I'd have a hangover, a big hangover. But it's been every now and then when I've been in Bangkok or I've been traveling through the region, I go and do a bit more filming. And so we finished filming and I've got a script. So I've been following my script and I've filled in all the gaps. And we've recently completed filming. We've got 60 hours of footage. So now we have to go into post-production. Now, I've so far in the 15 years, I've just spent all my own money trying to get all the shots, getting crew involved, traveling, accommodation, et cetera, et cetera. Now it's the editing where we put the film together. So we have to pay editors. We have to pay for music composition. We have to pay for grading and color.
Yeah.
Grade and color the footage. We have to do a sound mix. We have to get a narrator on board.
Yeah.
Now, I think I'm allowed to say this, but the narrator at the moment that I'm looking at is Liam Neeson.
Wow.
And Liam Neeson has indicated he's interested in doing it, but it's subject to the rough cut.
Yeah.
So he would do it depending on, I mean, the film's turned out okay, you know.
Yeah.
So that's all good. But we need somewhere in the region of, you know, $300,000 to do all that, basically.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. A lot of people to pay.
And I'm so disappointed with part of that news.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are you?
Why Liam Neeson when you got me here, mate?
Well, but what about me? What about me?
Hey, I'm your backup, okay?
Daddy, we don't have the music rights for that.
If anything happens to Liam, I'm putting the hand up, okay? Hey, dear listeners, and we're going to give them the why in our next podcast together. We're going to hear this Father Joe story and all the lessons from your experience with Father Joe, and we will give the listeners the why they might contemplate getting involved in a tax deductible donation to the film.
Because the film is registered with the Australia Documentary Foundation, which is a charity-based organisation.
Terrific.
So any monies they might care to donate, which would be fantastic, is 100% tax deductible.
Wonderful, mate. Wonderful.
And there's a website they can go to?
Yeah.
All right, and we'll put that website in the show notes.
Oh, give us the website now. I want them to hear it. Go.
I don't know.
You don't want to. It'll be in the show.
You're expecting me to remember the website.
Yeah. I was doing the low risk.
I can't remember everything, you know.
Yeah. And Bernie just threw you in
there. There we go.
Chip, finish it off, please, because I'm not going to finish this off without you saying your thank yous to the experience that you've had this morning, mate. You have been the pig in mud. Take it away, T-Chip.
It's been a mini film school, and it's been inspiring, and it's been educational, and it's been fortifying. And James, I just want to thank you for being a part of a journey
with Bernie and Chip. Goodbye, dear listeners, and thank you for listening. Hey, look forward to that next episode with James Lingwood. It's going to be an absolute ripper. Goodbye for now.
Thanks, Bern. Thanks ad infinitum to James. And thank you, listeners, you great wildebeests on the quest for wisdom, for sticking around till the end of this episode and joining me, Chip Lachlan Huddy, for the wrap-up, the sign-off, the take-home pay for this episode, where I try to pull together the most impactful themes of the podcast you just listened to and offer some hard, fast, concrete action steps so that you can start applying the wisdom of our guests to your own life, not next week, not tomorrow, but right now and today. And I think that today we have to talk about following your joy. You can hear it in James' voice, can't you? In everything he says, in the story of his life he tells. Here is a man who found his joy and never once turned away from it. And not only didn't turn away from it, but made it a mission to find ways to enable himself to continue following his joy. And that joy was making films, obviously. And he made it a hard-edged purpose in his life to find a way to make the pursuit of his joy a possibility in the face of a world that put value on other things. And that other thing I'm talking about, obviously, is money. James wanted to make films. To make films, he had to make money. So he just kept finding people who would give him money to make films. And the beauty is that he never gave priority to anything but his joy. And that includes his security. I mean, this guy literally went on an adventure to another country, to Hong Kong, to find people who would enable him to do the thing that brought him joy. Now, this is exactly what we're talking about when we talk about the modified existence. Don't turn your back on money. Don't turn your back on the need for security and safety and stability, but find a way to make it work for you. That's the take-home pay for this week, guys. Find your joy and then find a way to make it work for you. And the action step is so simple. Action steps, rather. Okay, so here they are. And I want you to get a pen. I want you to open a note app on your phone because you're going to need it, okay? Now, I'm going to give you 5 seconds to do that. I'll count you in. Ready? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, here we go. First step, I want you to write down that thing you love to do the most. You know what it is. Go on, write it down. Hit pause, write it down, then hit play again. Okay, I'll give you 3 seconds to hit pause. I'll count you in. 1, 2, 3. Okay, did you write it down? Did you really write it down? Because if you didn't write it down, I'll know, and there will be a consequence. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, second step. Write down the greatest adventure that that joy could take you on. So, for example, if it's making films, right? Maybe you get to make a film like Indiana Jones in 6 different countries. That's the most adventurous version of that joy. Huge adventure. Okay. Maybe your joy is coaching people. So if your joy is coaching people, maybe your great adventure is you get to coach someone who literally takes you to the moon. You know, one of those ridiculous executives like Jeff Bezos that's going to take you to the moon. Okay, maybe your joy is selling real estate. That's fine. So maybe that joy takes you to the heart of the Amazon jungle where you get to sell a luxury, sustainable treehouse to a genuinely lovely, rich couple who deserve a luxury Amazon treehouse. You see what I mean? Okay, so write that down. Pause the podcast, write that down. Hit pause in 3, 2, 1. Okay, done? Let's proceed. Third step now, really important. Just like James did when he went to Hong Kong, write down how you'd find someone to pay you to do that thing that brings you joy. Okay. Maybe you have to do some Googling. Maybe you have to work your network. Maybe you have to get on LinkedIn. Maybe you just have to talk face-to-face with some people. Wouldn't that be a magnificently novel thing? At the very least, I want you to write down these words. Research who would pay for whatever X you're offering, okay? So pause the podcast. Write that down. Write it down in 3, 2, 1. Okay, got it? Let's proceed. Fourth step, final step, find those people you wrote down in step 3. Contact those people you found in step 3 and just start the conversation. You don't need to sell them. You don't need to convince them. You just need to start the conversation. Ask how you can help them realize their joy so that you can realize your joy. And then everybody gets paid. It's simple, isn't it? It's not easy, but it's simple. And I tell you what, if you're stuck on any one step, just drop my old buddy, Jimmy Lingwood, a line on email. Tell him Chip sent you. He's got a lot of good ideas, that bloke. I trust him with my life. And that's all from me, beautiful people. I'm Chip Huddy. This has been Chip's Take Home Pay. And I do hope you found some pay worth taking home. As always, my friends, auf Wiedersehen, and just remember,